8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Knotfest.com presents Talk to Me. With over 300 interviews under his belt and 6 years running, your host Joshua Toomey interviews metal and rock's heaviest hitters. Follow the show at Talk to Me Talk. Here's your host, Joshua Toomey.
Hi guys, let's welcome Tyler Riley of Gideon back to the Talk to Me podcast here at Knotfest.com. Tyler, man, it is good to see you in person. Yeah. And how you been, man?
I've been well. How have you guys been?
We've been great, man. You know, obviously last time I ran into you was Louder Than Life. And obviously you're going to be doing, you know, Welcome to Rockville soon, all that. How is it just kind of playing the festivals, man?
Man, kind of a dream come true, I guess. Like, especially those festivals, Danny Wimmer Presents festivals are the best run festivals in the country for sure. We're playing, we've, you know, had the luxury of playing like almost all of them now, and I think we're knocking off two more of them this year. Then the next couple of weeks we're doing Rockville and Sonic Temple.
Nice.
So man, yeah, it's really incredible. Like, we've seen the, like, in our live shows, after playing those, it's made a huge difference. People that like to buy, you know, people who buy VIPs, you know, every person that comes to one is like, I saw you at this festival, I saw you at that festival.
Right.
It really is like a place where I feel like fans that really like to support the artists really congregate. So it's not just about playing in front of people. It's like gaining the kind of fans that want to support you. And man, it's crazy what it's done for us in the last year.
Yeah, I think that festival crowd is a little bit different than your typical going out every night to the local punk rock club crowd. You know, they
absolutely.
And it's almost like a cosign when you get on a Danny Wimmer festival or a Knotfest or something like that, where they're like, okay, these are the bands that are good, so you should support these bands. And then you get out there, and you know, next time you come through town, you know, you've played in front of so many people.
Yeah, I'd say it's some kind of rite of passage to be able to play them. And I'd say even like 5 years ago, I would look at these festivals and be like, man, no bands like my band are ever right. going to get to play one of these things. And yeah, it's just crazy. It's a testament to how much the music scene has evolved. Mm-hmm. The metal scene has evolved, really. Cause you know, there was new metal and, you know, mainstream kind of rock stuff, but there was not anything that was like metalcore. Was just, it still felt underground, even as soon as 5 years ago to me. So yeah, I remember seeing a couple of our friends' bands getting on one and just being mind blown that they had to do it.
Right.
Yeah. And then last year we got to do it. So it's, you know, times are changing. It's crazy.
It's like the last few years, my favorite artists are coming out of the metalcore scene. My favorite new bands, even though you're not a new band,
yeah,
but the new bands to me are all these bands that kind of grew up in the underground, kind of grew up in that, you know, even, you know, Gideon and, you know, I don't know if you guys play churches or not, but I mean, the whole church scene and,
oh, yeah,
and then kind of crossing over into, you know, secular clubs and things like that. Kind of talk a little bit about, well, let's just go all the way back before we dive into all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you as a guitar player, what kind of brought you to the instrument? What was there a certain person, you know, did you watch a TV show, any of that stuff?
Yeah, there was, well, I grew up kind of like around my dad and he had a band. My dad was in the church band, first of all. My mom and my dad, when I was as far back as I can remember, my mom sang like backup, and she sang some songs like lead or whatever. She's got an amazing voice. And my dad would lead the band at church, the church that we grew up in. And it was pretty, you know, at the time seemed like a pretty, you know, big congregation. He was really good as a songwriter. And, you know, so they'd have rehearsals at the house, and he would write original music, all kind of Christian rock tunes. And he had a couple really cool, he had a really good members in the band, a guitar player that shredded like crazy. And I always remember just sitting, you know, around or bopping around their rehearsals and kind of the guitar was really like my it was my dad's thing, but he didn't, he wasn't like a shredder. He was more like a songwriter. Mm-hmm. He would play very passionately, play acoustic very passionately, and play electric every now and again. But yeah, this guy he had in his band shredded. So I would be a little kid just enamored by this guy's skill. And still, like I've listened as I think as recently as like a couple years ago, I went back and listened to one of those recordings, and I was like, man, that guy still rips. Like it wasn't just because I didn't know what I was doing.
Right.
Yeah. But so then I actually inherited a guitar from my grandfather. There's a crazy story about that one, but my grandfather didn't play. But the story goes that my grandmother or his brother played, and his brother was down on his luck and kind of came into town to stay with them. And all he had was his guitar. And my dad used to say that my grandma was a little like sweet on his uncle. And so my grandpa kind of, despite his brother, was like, I'm going to fucking learn guitar. So he's like, you don't have any money. I'll buy your last. Right. Thing that you have, I'll buy this guitar from you. And he never learned to play, but my dad played on it a lot. It's a 70s SG, and I still have it. But yeah, I inherited that when my grandfather passed away. I was in about second grade, and that's when I started to get a little, you know, I was kind of fascinated with the guitar itself. I was kind of a tinkerer, you know, I like to take things apart still. I do that stuff. But and then in around third grade, I was just like, I started learning. I learned like a Metallica song, and the rest is kind of history. But and then there's one more pivotal moment. I lived with my uncle in seventh grade, and I moved in, and he's a Nashville guy from way back. And I think he was about 27 at this time. I was in seventh grade, and he knew I was interested in music, and was like, and really all we did for over a year, every day I was homeschooled, and he was a computer scientist that stayed home all the time. And all we did was jam guitar and bass. And he used to take lessons with like Reggie Wooten when he was a teenager. And he's kind of in that crew of, there are a lot of like incredible players from back then, that like, Evan Brewer is one of them. He's a big metal guy, bass players, who they're the same age, and they grew up together playing. And so I just happened to luck into living with this, basically a virtuoso. My uncle is still like insane. And yeah, we just jammed every day, and it really got me into music. And I think after I went to like one metal show, cause there was a lot of playing blues and stuff like leading up to that. But I went to like some show at the Anchor way back, and it was like a Tooth and Nail showcase. It was like one of the first like times I got to see like heavy rock metal bands playing together, and I was like, this is crazy, I want to do that.
Obviously growing up in the church with your dad being in the band, and you know, the shredder guitar player playing, obviously you just mentioned Tooth and Nail, was the kind of the Christian metal stuff, the metal, you know, metalcore with the Christian tinge, all that stuff. Was that something you gravitated to, or is that something you got into because that's maybe what you could listen to? Like, was there a reason for that?
Yeah. So I kind of moved around a whole lot when I was a kid. And my immediate family, like my mom, like we kind of got out of going to church, and I started listening. This is late 90s. You know, I started hearing stuff like, you know, like Korn and Limp Bizkit and Slipknot and stuff like that around that time, and was really like gravitating toward that. And right as that was happening, my family like kind of came into some hard times, and I moved in with another uncle for a little while. And he was a lot more into, he was like, there are alternatives to this kind of music. You know, you don't have to listen to Korn. You can listen to Demon Hunter or something, you know. So yeah, I'd say that was probably around 2004, I started kind of getting into the Christian metal scene.
Okay.
And getting back into going to church. And that's around when I had started playing guitar, picking it up, playing a lot more, and joined the church band around that time. And that's when I first got like a taste of performing. I hardly knew how to play. I knew chords, and it would be just songs with, you know, letters on it for the chords. And then I just kind of started getting more and more extreme with my taste as well, just going down the rabbit hole. But a lot of really good, like, gateway bands into the, you know, there were the alternative bands, which I, not alternative like the genre, but I mean like a band that sounded like,
right,
you know, like a Thousand Foot Crutch sounded kind of like Rage Against the Machine or something like that back then, to me. And so there were those kinds of bands, and then there were bands that were just unique in the music, in the Christian music scene, and like bands like Blindside and stuff like that. Still awesome band. You know, you're just wading through. You go to a Christian bookstore and you look through what looks the coolest, or what label is this band on. You,
right,
you start to notice the different labels and attaching, like, okay, any band on that label, I'm down with, you know. So you're just buying CDs at the Christian bookstore and discovering some crazy stuff, you know. Really got me into a lot of bands.
The other side of that, did you, when you were, you know, getting a Slipknot or a Korn or a Limp Bizkit, I mean, were you labeling it as something else, or were you like throwing those CDs in with the, you know, the DC Talk or something, you know? Yeah.
No, I wasn't I was being offered the alternatives, but I wasn't being like reprimanded too much for being into those. I think it was because it wasn't, because I was coming from my, you know, living with my mom and then moving in with an uncle. He was really gracious about it. And I could tell, and I knew other people who weren't able to listen to that stuff. And I kind of recognized that was really gracious of him. So I feel like in a way I kind of was like, okay, I'm going to try. And plus I was really getting into my faith at that point. You know, I'm a young teenager. And I wanted to do better. And that, you know, at that time for a little bit, I really thought like it was wrong to listen to this, to some of that stuff that I liked. And it wasn't, that didn't last for very long. Cause then I started, you know, getting on the road as an early teenager. And it was just like, man, we love listening to these new metal albums on the road.
Right.
And still. And I truly never, with the exception of maybe that couple of years when I was 13 years old or so, like, I didn't really stop listening to new metal. I kept listening forever, right, you know. But a lot of people fell out of it and fell back into it. And, you know, I just always thought it was awesome.
So going from playing in the church band, you know, when do you start playing in actual bands? Like, when do you get a band together?
Yeah, around high school age, I joined a band. And, yeah, it was an interesting transition because the people in my church band really relied on me at that point. And I was even kind of leading the band for a little while for like middle schoolers. So as touring started coming in, I was like, I think I did my first tour when I was 17 or 16, something like that. And that was a quick, like, you know, 2 weeks or something. Yeah. Came back from that and was like, whatever I got to do to continue to do that.
Right.
That's,
you got a taste.
Cool. That is way cooler than what I'm doing. But yeah, I had people in my church band telling me that like I was going down the wrong path in music. And to me, like in our band, I was, you know, we were all involved in the church, our band, and was like the most outreach we had ever, any of us had done aside from the occasional missions trip or whatever. Like, mm-hmm, we looked at it like it was our mission to be out on the road, you know? And so I kind of was like, man, that was one of the clear like moments where I felt opposed with the vision of my church.
Yeah.
It was interesting, I thought. But yeah, just around high school, 16, 17 years old, I started playing metal and I never stopped.
Yeah. So you're saying you're going on tour, like how, what was the band doing, you know, when you joined? Was it already established band when you joined that was starting to tour? Or, you know, yeah, what was the, you know, obviously now you put out a record, you tour behind it, yeah, to like back then I remember touring, because you just wanted to tour. Like, you're like, I don't know what this is, but we're going to book 2 weeks and we're going to go figure it out
on the road.
So what was the band up to at the time?
Yeah. When I joined the band, they had played a few out of town shows, and I, in fact, like the first show I played with the band, they were called As How Retreats. The first show I played with them was at Western Kentucky University. Oh, we drove up and brought the gear up there, and actually in like the corner cafe, kind of corner of a Subway like sandwich store on campus. They did metal shows in there back at that point. And so we were always trying to, you know, see how far out can we go and play a show. Like, the band was pretty established in Nashville and had been for how many years? For about 4 years at that point. It's crazy. I don't even know what they were up to all those 4 years. I think I had started seeing them play about a year and a half before I joined the band. You know, they had been playing locally and then trying to, you know, reach out to Memphis or Chattanooga or, you know, Huntsville, playing in Kentucky. And and then the first tour that we this was MySpace days at that point. You would just find, you know, bands that were somewhere around your size, or you'd play with them up in Kentucky, you'd play with them in Memphis, and you'd see a tour flyer that they did and all the names of the places that they went. And you would go find them on MySpace. You'd find that venue and just send them a cold message and say, can we play a show there on this day? We booked our own tours for years, you know, at the beginning. And it was, you know, we would save up as much money as we could. Usually it wasn't very much, maybe a couple hundred dollars, if that, and just try to see how long we could make it. And I don't know how we never got truly stranded or, you know, stuck somewhere like that, but we made it work.
It's good. Yeah. I've always talked about, even on this podcast and other places, just, you know, obviously I grew up here, played music here also. And like, you know, 2 or 3 hours in every direction is another major city. Like, that's the one, like, I got asked one time, like, what's so great about living in Nashville? And I was like, well, one thing is, really any direction you go, you're going to find a major city. So you can go do a couple of shows and you know, St. Louis, Memphis, come home, Knoxville, Lexington, you know, you can go and do weekends and kind of come back and then, you know, book a tour and build a tour off of that. You know, you're not in North Dakota where you've got to drive 9 hours to the next major town.
Yeah, absolutely.
And obviously the other crazy part about being from here is, like you said, the dude in the church band is a shredder, you know, like everyone's a shredder. Like that was the one thing they always talk about with Nashville crowds being so hard to play for, is because everyone in the crowd is a better guitar player than you.
It's true.
You know, so it's like you get a lot of like crossed arms and you're like, I could do that. You know, but no, it's been a great town, and I always love coming back.
Yeah. It really is. The biggest part is just a community of so many people that you don't play everyone plays music.
Yeah.
You know, like people that you hang out with, they play music, whether you play with them or not. You just kind of assume everyone plays music.
Right.
Like, and everyone kind of assumes you play music, you know?
Yeah. That was the nice, like, even, you know, growing up in the Hendersonville area, like everyone's dad plays in someone's band, you know. It's like,
yeah, for real.
It's like everyone,
they had some hit.
Yeah.
Like everyone's dad is a songwriter.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I recorded our first record that I recorded with that band was in Brent Mason's basement, because his daughter or his stepdaughter or his daughter was just one of our friends. And we used to go swim in her pool. And then it's like, cool, we have this little studio in the basement, and he would pop his head in there. I mean, he had Grammys and you know, platinum records around the rec room or whatever. That's the kind of stuff that you just kind of fall into when you live in Nashville. And I was fucking 16 years old, trying to do harmonic tapping solos and Brent Mason, the most recorded country guitar player in history, I think, in his basement somehow.
Yeah. It's always fun to see those dudes too. Like, if you're in a recording studio in a session or whatever, and you see those dudes come in and they're like, hey, we need a guitar solo in C, and they just sit down, you know, shit out a perfect guitar solo and just walk out, you know, with their bag or whatever.
Top tier.
Yeah. It's a wild town.
Especially when you come through some, you know, our our genre was very niche when it started. And when we started, it was because, I don't know, it's kind of like the Nashville rejects in a way, you know, like we weren't quite good. I wasn't quite good enough. I mean, if I would have kept doing it, I was just so gung ho about going on the road,
yeah. You
know, that it was like, this is good enough to get on the road. Yeah. Okay. Let's go on the road. But, you know, like the guys that weren't good enough to play country just went out and, you know, you could play anything here. It's not just country.
Right.
Country city is music city. But yeah, then I came full circle and now I love country, and it's all,
yeah,
it's great to be where I'm at.
Yeah. That was the one thing. Hendersonville obviously being synonymous with like Johnny Cash, and,
yep,
and like everybody I grew up around had a Johnny Cash story. They ran into him, you know, at the Electronic Express, they ran into him at McDonald's or whatever. And I never saw him, and I'm so bummed. I never got to run into him.
From when I was a baby. It was more of my parents, yeah, than me, but evidently he held me because we saw him, and I was like, who is that, Dad? And he was like, oh, man. You know,
well, hello.
That was funny because the little kid didn't know who he was,
right,
but everyone else was just gawking at him. And so I guess he held me for a second and hopefully gave me some of his power, right, you know.
You go, who is that? And he goes, hello.
Yeah.
Johnny Cash.
I'm Johnny Cash.
They always said that that's what he would do at McDonald's. He would go for on the Sunday and grab an ice cream.
Yeah.
And he would actually do that at the drive through window.
And
they, you know, get it. Yeah.
On Main Street.
Main Street. Yeah. Right there in Main Street. Just hanging out. But
I believe it.
So going from As Hell Retreats to, you know, do you go straight from there to Gideon, or what do you do?
Yeah. We in 2012, As Hell Retreats broke up, and we. As Hell Retreats broke up, so I thought that I was going to stop playing music, but we'd played a lot with Gideon. I think we did like 7 tours with Gideon before As Hell broke up. We went to California for the first time together. We did a lot of stuff together, a lot of firsts. I had filled in for the band quite a few times leading up to us breaking up, and they had just lost a guitar player in 2012 when I decided that we were done, and they were like, we just come fill in. And I was like, man, like I kind of have come to terms with the idea of not playing anymore, you know, because we're playing our final show coming up. And I was like, man, I guess I've done enough. I've seen a lot of cool stuff, you know, but they kind of convinced me to just fill in. And I continued to fill in for a while and kind of refused to join the band. And then eventually we were like, you're just in the band.
Right.
It's like, yeah, it's been years. So yeah, that was, yeah. So we always say that I've been in the band since 2012, cause that's when I started like full-time playing with them. And,
yeah, how old would you be?
Very easy transition though.
How old were you in 2012?
2012. I was, 21.
So at 21, you'd already like felt like you had seen everything, done everything. And I was like 23 when I like really left my like final band.
Yeah.
And like, I remember being that age and thinking that like, I was like, if I start a band now, I won't be 20. I'll be 28 by the time like something happens. You know, you just feel 1,000 years old at 21 or 23. Yeah. I mean, were you kind of feeling that way too?
Like, yeah. I had peers that had a plea for purging, man, from Nashville. Like they had broken up with As Hell Retreats. Like they kind of confided in one of us that they were breaking up. And then the conversation kind of went around our band, and we're like, damn, man, if they're breaking up, like we're going through some shit. We had some label problems, and we were like, we were doing as good as we had ever done, but it felt like things were like, we had just been dealt a major setback in our timeline. And so we kind of were like, man, why? One of the guys was interested in, you know, starting a family, and like, it just, the conversation was really honest, and we just decided to break up. We were like, let's just do it. Let's do it together. You know, but the plea for purging guys were 30 at the time, you know, and I was like, damn, old ass motherfucker, 30 years old. And, I thought to myself, like, well, once I started playing with Gideon again, I was like, I mean, I'll give it till I'm 30 at least,
right.
You know, if they can do it till they're 30, they still felt young to me. Like they were like older brothers to me, but, and still are, but yeah, I kind of gave myself till 30 at least to figure it out. But yeah, I still felt at the time, like I was a grown up and like I had done everything I needed to do.
Right.
I played like one show in Canada and most of the states in the United States, and really did it ourselves, you know. Mm-hmm. But that was it. That's all we had done at that point. Little did I know I was about to jump into a lot of stuff that I had never done.
Yeah. I always think it's wild when you look back at people that don't even touch a tour or touch an album until they're in their 30s or close to 30. Like those dudes to me, like when I was younger, I might have like been like, just give up the dream, man. Like, go get a job. But now I'm like, I think it takes a lot for people to persevere that long and not even touch a decent band and then finally get their, you know, get their shot.
You know, with the way things have been going the last year and a half and the last couple, 3 years, really, like a lot of things that I thought were so out of reach have happened to me. So I'm like, just keep going, man. If you can, like, just keep trying, because you really have no idea when something, you can't put any real timeline on it. It can happen for everyone. It can happen and a thousand different ways, you know. Right. It could happen tomorrow. It could happen in 10 years. It's just, if you can handle continuing to put yourself, you know, to sacrifice what you have to sacrifice to do what we do, then you should, I think.
Yeah, there's so many people that outside circumstances come along, you know, you kind of like this, it's like you're kind of going to the top and like people are just falling off like left and right, you know, with their, you know, like families and kids and, you know, maybe a parent gets, anything can happen. And all of a sudden you're just home and working your job, you know, and I
pandemic taught us exactly what it would be like. So
you're like, no.
I kind of have a better idea now than ever before.
Yeah, let's not do that. Let's try to tour as much as we can.
Yeah.
So when do you do your first record with Gideon?
So when I joined 2012, the record had just come out. I think it came out that summer. It might have come out like right after I joined the band, but it was right around when I joined the band. So it was a couple years, I think 2014, before I did my first record with them. But I will say I had small little parts on the first two records that I was somewhat involved in. just like writing a lead here and there, one riff, stuff like that. So we were around for the process.
Okay.
But yeah, I think it was 2014. I'm bad with dates.
Yeah, you're fine. I mean, and the Gideon guys are from Alabama, right?
Yeah.
Are they still down there? Or are some of them up here? Or what's going on?
One of them is still down there.
Okay.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. Like the band, you know, As Our Treats was from Nashville. We had Gideon from Alabama. And then there was this other band called The Advocate, which was Dan's band and from Mississippi.
Okay.
And because of our proximity and we were all around the same age, like Jake and I, our drummer, he's someone that's still in Alabama. We're within a couple months of the same age. So right at the same time and from different places, we were doing the same thing. We were trying to get away from, really, we were just trying to get out, you know, and be independent and play music and do something that we were stoked about all at the same time. But yeah, so Dan's from Mississippi, Jake's from Alabama, and Caleb, our bass player, is from North Georgia, and he was doing the same thing. He's a couple years younger than the rest of us, but he was doing the same thing at the same time. He played one of Gideon's, I think he played Gideon's first like EP release show or something, like with his local band when he was a little kid, basically. Swoopy hair,
nice, yeah. All of that. Dude, I've been so down the rabbit hole of like, there's a, I think an Instagram account. I think it's like something like the MySpace scene or something about that, and it's all old videos of every swoopy haired band, like early videos of those guys, and it's all the swoopy haired bands and just the you know, crabcore and all doing the same moves and stuff. But I mean, like it's such an innocent time in music to me. And I think it's because I was a little bit older at the time when that stuff came out, and like all the kids around me, like 14, 15, 16, 17, they all started bands and they all looked like that. And it's just like,
it was overwhelming at the time.
Yeah,
for sure. I could see it kind of because I came more from the new metal part of stuff. Like that was my first time I ever heard someone scream in a song was a Slipknot song, I think, you know? And so like, I was involved in that because really I feel like it was because it was the most accessible thing and then quickly became the most like trendy thing,
yeah.
you know, as a young teenager that was happening, even in Nashville, Tennessee, where, you know, that seems like the furthest from like a redneck thing that you can think of. It was clearly a powerful movement, the emo thing. I think it was about being, individuality, for younger kids and in a time when, you were butting heads with just as you're butting heads with your parents and what your parents want. Like so much of that music felt like it was angst, you know, mm-hmm. it was the teenager's perspective and not, you know,
yeah.
a grown up. I appreciate it. It's the whole movement.
Oh yeah.
I had crazy hair for a couple years too. So
flat iron and the yeah. Yeah, in the Hot Topic tees at the time, you know, all neon green colors or neon colors and super extra smalls and yeah. everything else, man. Everybody
youth large,
yeah,
youth medium.
You gotta see how scrawny you could get to be yeah. a band.
Gosh, not healthy.
No, not healthy at all. And the other thing too is you kind of talked about it there was, you know, your bass player playing one of Gideon's first shows or first, you know, the EP shows, and like looking back on all those early tours and you still like feel like, oh my God, that guy is in this band now. And like, I'm sure there are people even on probably your first or second ever tour that are now in an established band that you're like, it's crazy how those early connections stay with you throughout all this.
Absolutely. It's one of the most surprising things. The older I get, like the more it happens, that people are, I don't know, it's just going to keep happening. You know, I think that's what it's like to be in your 30s and your 40s, like, you know, eventually I'm going to have people that I played some show with that are senators or something, you know.
Yes, yeah, right, that too, you know? Yeah.
But right now it is like in the music industry, it's really crazy. Mm-hmm. It's really, you just feel a sense of pride though. It's like we all kind of came from the same place, and if they can do it, I can do it. Like that's kind of how it feels to me. Like I know that there's a dude that played metal in a band from somewhere in Tennessee around my age that plays, he's like Morgan Wallen's guitar player.
Oh, right. Yeah.
You know, like, and we used to play shitty, you know, VFWs or, uh-huh. you know, they were just one of the bands that we used to play with from right outside of Nashville. So, you know, there are about 100 or more examples of that in my life. And it doesn't get old.
You're right.
It's crazy.
Yeah, like Jelly Roll's whole band is like old emo dudes.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's really wild.
Yeah. I posted a flyer the other day and I was like, the opening band on the bill from my old band, I was like, what band did that become? And it was Shinedown.
Yeah, what were they called?
Dreve.
Okay.
DR. Yeah, they were from Knoxville. But it was funny. I was like, you know, I look at those old flyers now. I'm like, well, that guy's in Five Finger Death Punch. And that guy's in Dreve, you know, Shinedown. Yeah. And, you know,
like, it really is like, it really is the guys that they want to do it. Mm-hmm. They just continue and they grow and everybody joins forces. Really. That's how Gideon became what it is. It was our four bands,
yeah.
four guys that were, as far as I know, well, there are a couple guys out of our four bands that mm-hmm. are still do music, but I mean a couple.
Yeah.
That we're really the main four that continued to play music and ended up together. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It takes a certain mindset, you know, where you want to be, you want to do it, you try not to get anything else in the way of doing it. And, yeah, it's hard. I mean, it's a tough life to try to do.
Yeah, it takes a certain kind of coping skills and personality and everything.
Yeah,
you know, opportunity, skill, your ability to handle all of the stuff that comes along with it, and you know, support systems and all of that. It's like really a perfect storm. Anyone that's playing music has somehow. You know, struck some kind of crazy balance, impossible balance in their life to make it happen, really. You know, especially anyone who's been doing it for 10, 20 years, for sure, you know.
With we'll kind of fast forward up to the new album, and I looked at it, I was like, it's almost been out a year now, right? Or just, yeah, and it just hit a year.
Yeah,
right?
Just hit a year.
Like,
yeah.
So, you know, having it out a year, like, how do you feel about it now? And do you look back on it fondly?
Yeah, definitely. I love it. I love the album still. I feel like it's the thing to beat at this point for us. And being, it feels like it's been out for more than a year because a lot has happened since it came out. But yeah, it was March last year that it came out. But yeah, we're ready to like take it another level further than that. And I think you learn a lot about yourself and about your band and about writing and everything every time you put a record together, and especially when it's the same guys and it has been for a few records now, all the same people working on the record. It's like you zero in more and more and more every time you do a project. So I hope that bodes well for the next thing that we do. Yeah.
You know, playing the festival scene and playing the Louder Than Lifes and Rockvilles and all that, do you see what works and doesn't work for a crowd that size now? And you're like, all right, well, this will work like in a small club at a, you know, 200 cap room that's, you know, fully enclosed. But once you get out to those giant stages, do you feel like, all right, I got to write some stuff like this?
Yeah, in a way. But I think like way back when we played, I'm trying to take what year it was. It's been almost 10 years, but we played a couple pretty decent sized tours way back when, with one with For Today, particularly is when I remember playing over to over 1,000 people a night, you know, or 1,000 people over a few times over the tour. Yeah. Was like, I mean, huge accomplishment for us for the first time.
Yeah.
And I think that's when it clicked, like that there was another kind of, you know, energy in a crowd that's bigger than a tiny room, another thing to tap into. And we've been trying to, I feel like we've all been, whether consciously or subconsciously, kind of honing in on that over the years. And it felt like playing those festivals or getting in front of a big crowd was just like all we needed to finish the puzzle, if that made sense, you know? So I think that we've been working on it for a long time. And I think we already kind of have the idea of how that works. And luckily, like we, you know, I think Incarceration was the first one of the big ones that we did. And we really saw that it just all worked like exactly like we hoped that it would work. And we've been carrying that through, but we think about that stuff. Like when the next record comes out, it's like, there has to be something that's going to be, you know, that we play at every festival, you know, every big crowd needs to have that song, you know, right. Like we think about that stuff constantly.
Last time you and I talked about the record, I mean, we obviously hit on that you're not even hiding the fact that you have new metal influences, you know, there's like DJ scratching on it and you know, it's a little bit of like a little bit of a rap element to it, you know, not necessarily rapping, but it's, you know, it's got a little flow there. Talk about just kind of bringing that element into the band.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many good albums, so many good new metal albums that have like two or three very translatable songs or parts that translate into metal. I mean, into our kind of metal, into metalcore, you know, something with a breakdown, you know, even in the late 90s, you know, that was a possibility in new metal music. So like with taking like this, I feel like a lot of it is tempo and the flow of parts and that make it sound and feel new metal. And I don't know, I feel like it's a lot about like just dissecting why does it feel like this, you know, and bringing the feeling of it than necessarily just like your stereotypical you know, Korn guitar lead or something like that, right, that makes it sound new metal. Like, right, to me, that's not like, I think at first glance, like that's what people go, oh, this is what new metal sounds like. It's a chorus pedal on some weird part, you know? but I don't know. I think we try to go deeper than that. And it's, to me, it's just a lot about the feel. And like you said, you know, about it being like, about music being written for different sized crowds and things like that. Like that's the other thing about new metal is that it was one of the most, I mean, up to that point, you know, it was the most commercially successful, you know, aside from Metallica and the big, you know, those big ones.
Right.
Like it was about the festival. Like, we still reference, we still go back and watch videos of Woodstock 99 and constantly, you know, and that shit worked for huge crowds. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we try to take, why did that work for that? Like, because of the way it felt and the tempo and the jump and the where the snare was landing and whatever, and apply that stuff. Because I don't know, I just think it wasn't like, it wasn't just a blip in the music history and now it's gone. I think that there's a ton to be learned from it, and I think it lives and it's growing, it's coming back, it's growing.
Yeah, watch that Limp Bizkit in Argentina.
Yeah, if you think new metal's gone, go watch Limp Bizkit in Argentina. And
it's wild.
Yeah,
wild watching that. Have we talked about who the sample is? Is it Hank Jr. on the?
Yeah, it's okay. Hank Jr. We haven't. I think when we talked, I think you said that like we didn't want to say who it was.
Yeah, at the time you said, you know, we'll let people figure it out.
Most people have figured it out, but yeah, like people come up and it's not like we're gonna make a post like, okay, yeah, it was Hank Jr.
Ta-da, surprise! Yeah.
And actually, like I should state that we recreated all of the, it was from a Hank interview, but we recreated the recordings just to avoid any sort of trouble with it.
Yeah.
We felt so strongly about putting it on the record that we almost wanted it to be more of an ask for forgiveness thing. And that, but then the thought of having to take our whole record down when they're so integrated into the tracks sounded awful. And the label didn't like the sound of that either. So,
right.
So we just recreated them. But I feel like we really, I mean, if you listen to the back to back, the real ones and the, which no one will ever be able to, cause they were all edited together. Like, right. I think we're the only ones that would ever have that. But if you listen to them back to back, like, I think we did a good job of recreating them. But yeah, it was, his whole story was such an inspiration. It just felt like we understood how he felt in that, because the parallels and growing up in Christian homes and the way that he grew up trying to be like his dad, like it was insane. Mm-hmm. Parallel was so you know, it just felt, we felt it. Yeah.
Well, let's end off with I told you to give me your top five new metal albums. Oh, yeah. So what are you thinking? Just start from five.
Five. Okay. Man. So I'm only putting this at number five because there's new metal that I feel like predates this and is a lot more intrinsically new metal. But I'll put it as number five, Hybrid Theory.
Okay.
I think it's probably one of the best albums in this top five, I'm going to say, but as a whole.
Yeah. Thoughts on them coming back with a possible female singer?
I would see it.
Yeah.
I would see it, but maybe if I had seen them ever at all growing up, maybe I wouldn't, but
yeah, I saw them a few times back then, and you know,
I wouldn't be mad personally for them to come and, I mean, just to hear those songs
again. Yeah.
And for it to be a woman, it would be cool because you're not going to get as much comparison like
right.
As you would, I think, if somebody, you know, like this guy is not as good as Chester. Chester's impossible to replace. So right. He's got to be something different, I think. So that kind of makes sense to me.
The only thing I think is funny from the post is that the drummer and Han are not involved.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, where are they at?
I will say, as a huge Linkin Park fan of the first, you know, three releases that they did, I still feel like the drummer is the worst part of the band, but Mr. Han's the best part of the band. So it's not good.
Right.
So it's not good. I didn't even see that part.
Yeah. So number four.
So number four, I didn't actually write these down. So I'll say LD50.
Okay.
I think that there's Mudvayne's like my favorite new metal band, but I wouldn't say that they have the best album. You know, LD50 is incredible, and I think the style of the album is my favorite kind of new metal. But yeah, there's the records above them are impossible to beat, really.
All right.
You know, when Limp Bizkit exists, because they're up
there. It's hard to beat when Limp Bizkit exists.
Yeah.
All right, number three.
Number three, I'll say this is like a toss-up between either Follow the Leader or... Life is Peachy, probably.
Okay.
But I want to put Korn at 3, and I'm going to try to keep not put more than one record from each band in the top 5.
Yeah.
And I kind of want to put two Limp Bizkit records in there. But yeah, I'll say Follow Leader.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was once that album kind of.
Defined.
The first album, you know, was great. Life is Peachy, great, you know, has great songs on it, but I feel like it was rushed. Mm-hmm. And then the third album, they actually got, you know, they got the big studio, they got the time to do it. They took their time.
Value that.
And it sounds like that.
Yeah, and even Hybrid Theory is like Meteora kind of. And I know that Hybrid Theory defined the band, but Meteora to me might be better because. Mm-hmm. For that same reason, it sounds amazing. They spent a ridiculous amount of time on that record. Everything about it is perfect to me.
That's what happens when your debut album goes like 15 times platinum.
Exactly. There's a few mil.
You get a little extra time.
Take the time.
Right.
Like, take some Beatles time in the studio. I'm pretty sure they took, I don't remember the exact number, but it was a ridiculous amount. If you can find it on Wikipedia, it might be a year, like an entire year in the studio. It might be like 7-8 months or something like that. But
I've always thought too, like when you hear it takes a band a year to record it, like what are you doing in the?
You're not in the studio the whole time.
You know what I'm saying? Like you're just like
like you go and you don't leave.
You know your parts when you get there. The songs are already written. Like let's go.
No, they're writing in the studio.
Yeah.
And defining the entire project while in that
and a lot of takeout
for sure. But yeah. I'll take number 2. I'll do Iowa.
Oh, nice.
I mean, and that's hard. All of these, because I don't want to repeat one band, like all of these are, there's a debate. There's a debate to be had of which one is the best, but that's my favorite one.
Slipknot album. And I will say from what I've seen so far from Slipknot from this year, from the new, you know, the throwback red jumpsuits, you know, Corey's got the dreads again, Eloy being in the band, like all that stuff, man. This is actually probably the most excited I've been for Slipknot in a very long time.
Yeah. And I'm not so, I love Slipknot for sure. I think that they make some decisions that are difficult to understand sometimes, because I think Jay Weinberg is a crazy drummer. But when that happened, the words out of my mouth were literally like, I mean, the only guy they could get is Eloy. The only guy that beats that for me is Eloy. Yeah. And then that's exactly what happened. So
it was him that one-handed drummer. I think there was two dudes. And actually, somebody posted a picture with him the other day, and I was like, oh, it was the guy that's currently playing for Sepultura posted a photo with the one-handed drummer guy. And I was like, man, this is all like just coming together. Man.
That guy is really good.
Yeah.
And it would have been one of those two. I wouldn't be surprised if they would have asked him to, but Eloy is... Eloy's kind of in a league of his own when it comes to the drums, period.
Yeah, he's an amazing drummer.
Yeah, and Sepultura is awesome, but like Eloy is really awesome.
yeah.
You know. And number one, I would say it's between Chocolate Starfish and Significant Other.
Yeah, I mean, you can't go wrong there.
I'll say Significant Other, though, if I had to choose one.
Yeah, I mean... How can you go wrong?
Yeah, you can't go wrong. Ask me tomorrow.
Right. Tomorrow to be, you know.
$3 bill.
There we go. Well, Tyler, man, it's been absolutely amazing to, you know, get me catch up with you. And
absolutely.
And I even, you know, I said it, I don't know if I said it to you that day, but seeing you guys up there a lot of the life, just the crowd that was there for you guys, how good you sounded, like the whole thing, like, yeah. I felt like a proud dad. You know what I'm saying? It's just like, it's so awesome to see you up there, man.
Thank you, man. Thank you so much.
Thanks for taking some time.
Hopefully you get to check us out on another one.
Oh, absolutely.
It's been real.
Here we go.
The Talk To Me podcast presented by KnotFest.com. Follow the show at Talk To Me Talk. Be sure to subscribe, rate the podcast, and leave a review on your favorite podcast app to get the latest from the Talk To Me podcast.